The views expressed on AM360 by the host, hostesses, or guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Share Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific and personal medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to consult an advisor for your specific circumstances.
You are part of our 600,000 listening level, American Muslim 360.
That's interesting.
Assalamu alaikum. This is American Muslim 360 radio broadcast.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Malik Yawmiddin. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
American Muslim 360 is
too legit to quit.
We will never quit. American Muslim 360, your number one Muslim radio station.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
Community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at cwsconline@gmail.com. That's cwsconline@gmail.com. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa Allah wahdahu la sharika lahu. Wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu. Assalamu alaikum. This is Martha Naila Abdullah, one of the program managers for America Muslim 360 broadcast, and the parent body being that of Community Wide Shura Conference, Inc. Welcome, everyone, to Council on American Islamic Relations. This is their hour for presentation, and unfortunately, they have been away for a bit handling. Well, if you understand CARE, and our relationship here with CARE is that we're reaching out to the human family, avenues of connections for the injustices, not limited to any one race or to the entire human family. So we welcome you here on American Muslim 360 broadcast. We're thankful to be able to partner with CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, and get more in tune with how the process works and the benefits of people so far, thus far, say within the last year even. We're going to share some information on CARE. And if you have any questions or comments you'd like to share, and you've had a relationship with CARE, then please, by all means, press 1 on your phone. We will open your mic, and you can make your comment. All right? Of course, here is where your voice is protected and your intellect always respected. All right. We're going to look here at the board first and to see if – so we don't miss you. We don't want to miss you. It is now the hour for CARE on Air right here on American Muslim 360 broadcast. Thank you once again for being here with us, and we will be right back.
This is Rajia Mukman with Al Mukminu Islamic. You're listening to America Muslim 360, believer-supported radio. Assalamu alaikum. This is Rajia Mukman with Al Mukminu Islamic Center, asking you to become a contributing supporter of CWSC and AM 360 at the most popular giving level of just $9.99 per month. Visit CWSC.us today to make your tax-deductible gift, or call in your pledge at 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world. Thank you.
All right, we're going to go to the very first group that we would think of that are defenseless and need help and at all times. And, of course, there's two groups. You know, those that are children and those that are elderly, and, of course, those that are disabled. So three groups, right? All right. Now, we're going to share children and CARE. It's about 11 and a half minutes. All right? All right, while we're wanting that to be shared with you, we want to remind you that you can always go to MCNRD. That's on our website. On our website, you can go to MCNRD and become a partner with our volunteer. Excuse me, can become a volunteer. And you can become a partner also with Community-Wide Shura Conference. We welcome you. And if you have an organization or you're an individual, when you go to cwsc.us and you click on MCNRD, yes, those acronyms that stand for Model Community National Resource Directory, you will see the information for signing up. And if you know someone who's very, very much capable and have the time to volunteer, well, we're looking for them, right? We want their support as well. And when I say we, we're speaking about the entire human networking family. Because many times we overlook that which is available right in our, so to speak, in our backyard. So the evidence of any injustices, speaking of CARE now, the evidence of any injustices, you're open to contact the Council on American Islamic Relations and whatever area you are in. There's an office somewhere nearer to you, of course, that you will be able to contact whatever state you're in. But then there is the national office as well. And the National Executive Director is Mr. Niwad. Let's go to this Council on American Islamic Relations, or as it connects with children. All right. All right. Well, first then, let's go to this particular one. It's about 6 minutes. No, this is the El Paso Dayton episode that occurred September or August 2019. It's about 2.5 minutes.
On AM360, by the host, hostesses, or guests on their own, and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the community-wide Shure Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific and personal medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to consult an advisor for your specific circumstances.
You have listened to us over 500,000 times. American Muslim 360.
That's interesting.
Assalamu alaikum. This is American Muslim 360 radio broadcast.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Ar-rahmanir rahim. مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this regularly scheduled meeting of the Public Health, Environment, Civil Rights, and Engagement Committee. My name is Philippe Cunningham, and I'm the proud chair of this great committee. With me at the dais are Council Members Connell, Schrader, Vice Chair Gordon, Council Member Johnson, and Council Vice President Jenkins. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum and can conduct the business of this committee. Today we have 4 consent items and 2 items for discussion. I'll dive into the consent items, and if my colleagues would like to pull anything for discussion, please let me know. So our first item for consent is passage of a honorary resolution supporting Earth Hour 2019 on Saturday, March 30th, 2019, from 8:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., and also supporting Audubon's Lights Out campaign, which encourages building owners to turn off their lights during spring and fall migration. I wanted to just add to that that this started as a one city program, and then is now in 188, and we've been doing it since 2008. Our second is confirming the appointment of mayoral appointment for a 2-year term of Britt Culp. The third is a passage of resolution amending the previous Southside Green Zone resolution by adding 4 youth ambassador members. And then we also have a slew of council appointments. So I wanted to take a moment to give a shout out to folks because they bring so much expertise to the table. So I want to make sure that we give folks a proper shout out. So who we have here is first, we have Estella LaPonte, Seat 1, Ward 9, who is on the board of Little Earth Residents Association, a passionate activist for the environment who wants clean, healthy spaces for our children who are the future. Next, we have Scott Hartigan, Seat 2, Ward 6, served in his DFL district caucus multiple times, has nearly a decade of experience working with mentally disabled adults, gaining the experience to help such members of our community engage and participate in community initiatives and participate. Next, we have Amina Mohammed Hanaif, Seat 3, Ward 6, volunteered for years with the Cedar Riverside National Night Out and the Cedar Riverside Pop-Up Library Project. Next, we have Ashley O'Neill Prado, Seat 4, Ward 6, helps to facilitate a community urban garden in East Phillips and with Tamales East, E. Bicicletas, an avid cyclist who regularly uses the city's green spaces. Next, we have Cassandra Holmes, Seat 5, Ward 9, who is an active participant in the Southside Green Zone meetings, very involved with the Little Earth community and addressing concerns about pollution and food deserts. Next up, we have Jody Vermillion, Seat 6, Ward 9, who has worked in an urban farm with youth in the Little Earth community. She has experience in organic gardening, pollinators, and vegetable gardens. We have Joseph Golish, Seat 7, Ward 9, who works for a small solar installer, has attended many renewable and energy efficient workshops, is also an active board member of the Midtown Phillips Neighborhood Association. Next, we have Timothy Blyton, Seat 8, Ward 9, who works at the Hub Bike Co-op, where he is now a member owner. He volunteers for after-school programs at Anderson Community School and works as a sidewalk chalk artist for many events, including Open Streets and Northern Spark. We have Amanda Sathoff, Seat 17, Ward 11, safety manager with Illini Health at Abbott Northwestern Hospital and co-chair of the Illini Environmental Safety, Hazardous Waste, and Green Team. We have Jason Chavez, Seat 18, Ward 11, former resident of Phillips who experienced gardening in contaminated soils and unstable housing. He has been both an organizer and government employee, understanding how to hold elected officials accountable, but also work with them to make community-driven plans work. And then not least, we have Megan Cole Steins, Seat 19, Ward 9, has over a decade of experience working on waste reduction, air pollution, reduction and climate change, environmental justice, works for the Minneapolis Pollution Control Agency and lives in East Phillips. I just wanted to take a little bit of time to read through those. I know that was a lot of information, but we have a lot of folks who volunteer their time and carry a lot of expertise, so I want to make sure that we give them a shout out and really name how lucky we are as a city to have them volunteering their time. Our fourth consent agenda item is approving the council and mayoral appointments for the violence prevention steering committee appointments. And we have some folks here too that I want to give some shout outs to. So we have Roslyn Padasin, who is a founder and board chair of All Square, a civil rights nonprofit restaurant and professional development institute focused on supporting those impacted by the criminal justice system. She is also an attorney and investigator. We have Yolanda Evans, is the director of Partnership for Safe Communities with Project Minnesota, a role in which she supports the partnerships of social justice organizations, social services, and law enforcement to address group violence. She is also a member of the Governor's Early Learning Council and has a long history as a community organizer and resident of North Minneapolis. David Hottinger is the spiritual care director for Hennepin Healthcare, managing chaplains and spiritual care providers throughout the system, including HCMC. He provides direct spiritual support to victims of violence and their families, and in partnership with city partners, developed a hospital-based intervention program. We have Madison Stallman, a researcher with the Department of Veteran Affairs Medical Center with vast experience as a community advocate, including as founder and president of Helping Hands, which provides aid to homeless and displaced women in the Twin Cities. Lynn Crockett has deep experience as a community advocate, including a longtime parent liaison for North and Northeast area schools for Minneapolis Public Schools, and most recently as a member of MPS 2020 World's Best Workforce Advisory Committee and MPRB Request Community Advisory Committee for the North Service Area. We have Shane Zahn, who is the Director of Safety for the Downtown Improvement District, focusing on safety initiatives for downtown Minneapolis, which includes prevention, mitigation, response, and recovery efforts to violent crime downtown. He was formerly the Executive Director of Vibrant and Safe, formerly known as Safe Zone. And last, we have Happy Reynolds, who is a family medicine physician with Illini Health, whose clinical experience has cemented his belief that violence is a public health issue. Dr. Reynolds has also served on the city's Public Health Advisory Committee and the Youth Violence Prevention Committee. So with those, I wanted to say thank you to all of those who have volunteered, and thank you to the city staff who went through all of the applications to help find who has the skill sets and who we need at the table. So thank you for that. And with that, I move consent or move approval of all four consent items. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and those items carry. Next up, we will be receiving and filing information related to the mission and activities of the Office of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs since the office became operational in July 2018. We have our Director of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs, Michelle Rivero, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Committee Chair Cunningham, fellow committee members. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Cheyenne. My name is Michelle Rivera. I'm the Director of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs for the City of Minneapolis. Thank you very much. I'm giving a presentation, an annual report on the activities of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. It's a little early because the office has been in existence for 9 months. It's my intention to present annually at this time of the year a report on the activities of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. So the office is a one-person office located within the Department of Neighborhood and Community Relations. The principal purposes of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs are to inform elected officials and policymakers on immigration developments on a federal level and assist in the development of policies that support and protect our immigrant and refugee communities. An additional goal of the office is to ensure that affected immigrant and refugee community members are also aware of developments on a federal level and are equipped with the information necessary to support and defend their rights, including being put in access or in communication with organizations that provide legal assistance. An additional role of the office is to communicate immigration-related developments to individuals who are unimpacted by what we're seeing on a federal level, because we see that there are many unimpacted individuals who have a desire and inclination and motivation to provide assistance to impacted communities. Finally, a goal of the office is to foster partnerships with nonprofit organizations, with academia, with community organizations to provide assistance and support to immigrant and refugee communities. So with regard to informing and strategizing on federal immigration development, some of the activities that our office has been engaged in since I started working for the city in July 2017 include putting out an immigration bulletin that is issued at least monthly, if not biweekly, informing elected officials of developments on a federal level and identifying ways that the city can be responsive. In certain situations, I also recommend targeted actions impacting specific immigrant communities in response to activities on the part of the federal government. That includes, for example, Liberian deferred enforced departure, which the federal government has indicated will end on March 31st, 2019, ensuring that council members are aware and city officials are aware of this change and understand ways in which we can provide support to impacted individuals, including ensuring that they have access to counsel in legal clinic setting. An additional action that I suggested around December 2018 involved a response to the situation at the border where federal officials were using tear gas, and the City Council took the action of proposing a resolution criticizing the federal government for this action and encouraging immigration officials to respect and uphold our asylum laws. An additional activity that the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs has been engaged in more recently involves having monthly OIRA strategy meetings where City Council members and staff and selected individuals within city departments are invited to meet together to talk about the role and purpose of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs and assist in developing strategy of the office. So strategizing to increase community security and demonstrate city support. The Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs works with the nonprofit organizations Volunteer Lawyers Network, Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, and the Advocates for Human Rights to manage the contracts, which total $75,000 to these three nonprofit organizations, in providing legal services to immigrant and refugee communities. In a year from June 2017 to July 2018, that investment of funds resulted in direct services to approximately 1,600 individuals, which is a very economical use of resources in terms of number of individuals who are impacted. Part of the role of my office is to structure 2019 contracts with the three legal services organizations in a way that responds to needs that we are seeing in community. For example, support of individuals who are applying for citizenship, identifying ways to provide the potential of federal litigation assistance for delays in application processing, as we're seeing naturalization application delays twice the average time. And then also continuing to ensure that we are providing financial support to people who are facing immigration court removal proceedings.
I would like to go ahead and jump in with a question.
Yes.
So 1,600 is a really great number of folks with that amount of money. I'm curious, do we track the amount of folks who we support them not getting deported?
Yes, we do. And I do have information, the reports out from the different organizations. I'm happy to provide that detailed information. I do believe that the number is approximately 26 individuals who are saved from removal within that time period. Thank
great.
You for your question.
Yes, of course. Are there any other questions?
Another role of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs is to support impacted communities. This includes providing accurate and up-to-date information to impacted individuals through the Immigration Bulletin, which also goes out to members of the public, as well as the website. In addition to actually going out in community, the office holds community office hours with different trusted neighborhood and community organizations. I also help connect impacted individuals to legal service providers in what I call Rapid Response Legal Clinic and Information Session Model. Rapid Response Legal Clinic is, as the name would indicate, the provision of legal services in a rapid format. So if there is an emergency situation, for example, recently there was a situation where an I-9 audit took place at a local daycare and preschool. Impacted employees were concerned that the audit would result in an investigation of them and initiation of removal proceedings. Parents were also concerned about the potential impact of immigration officers potentially coming to the school. So what we did was to create a legal clinic, an all-day legal clinic for impacted staff members, and also a community forum where impacted staff could receive information from an experienced immigration business attorney to understand the I-9 application process and understand what resources are available in the Twin Cities area. Another aspect of my work is to go out to community organizations to identify what the needs are in those organizations. We have so many trusted organizations in not only Minneapolis and the Twin Cities area, and it's clear that trying to connect those community organizations that are well-trusted with legal service providers to ensure that people who go to those community organizations understand where the legal resources are as part of the work of the office. Another part of my role is to connect with federal, state, municipal, and county officials to identify resources to support community. So over the course of the 8 months that I've been employed the city of Minneapolis, I've connected with both senators' offices, representatives' offices, counterparts in St. Paul and Hennepin County to try and identify what those offices are doing and how we can partner together to support immigrant and refugee communities. So as I indicated, another large part of my role is to advocate for immigrant and refugee communities. Part of that involves going out to different organizations, whether it's churches, whether it's the Federal Reserve, to explain what I see as the problems and the difference between our immigration system today and our immigration system, say, 20 years ago, so that people have a more comprehensive understanding of the radical changes that we've seen over the course of the last 2 years. I also help identify ways in which the city of Minneapolis and its residents can provide concrete assistance to community members. And one thing that I've noticed is that there's such a great need and a desire to act and do something that is meaningful, and channeling people to the organizations that are providing that direct legal assistance is an excellent way to connect residents of the city of Minneapolis, both impacted and unimpacted by changes that we're seeing in the federal administration. I also present at local, regional, and national conferences on immigration and integration with the University of Minnesota Law School, being one, addressing the topic of sanctuary cities. Another upcoming conference will be at the University of Chicago on the subject of municipal ID and how that helps in immigrant integration. So another large part of the work of the office is to foster partnerships that strengthen and support immigrant and refugee communities. I've indicated some of the partnerships that we've started to establish here, including University of Minnesota, and there will be an upcoming grant to place a law student from the University of Minnesota within the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs for the summer. It's a grant of up to $6,500, which is an excellent way to not only have additional help and resources within the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs, but also foster a connection between this office, the City of Minneapolis, and academia. I think that that benefits not only the city of Minneapolis, but also helps to push out the work that we're doing on a national level. Community organizations, I have and will continue to have relationships with community organizations to try and identify ways that we can work together. Neighborhood organizations, for example, there was a meeting recently within the Hawthorne neighborhood, the Hawthorne Huddle, where a number of individuals with law enforcement, as well as university individuals and other people who are working to benefit community, learn about the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs and identify ways that we can work together. The American Immigration Lawyers Association, I have been a member of this organization for a number of years, and it has been especially useful in the city of Minneapolis from the standpoint of identifying attorneys who can quickly respond to needs of residents in a variety of different immigration-related contexts. And finally, as I indicated, federal, state, regional, county, and municipal offices, including the Minnesota Department of Health, and kind of seeing what programs are available on a state level that we can partner with as the city of Minneapolis. I've included a little bit of information regarding immigrant communities of Minneapolis. The population of the city is approximately 422,000 people. There are an estimated almost 62,000 foreign-born residents living in Minneapolis, which is approximately 15% of the population. I've broken down the percentage by race and ethnic origin. And then more broadly, immigrant communities within the state of Minnesota, the largest groups of foreign-born Minnesotans in the countries which they come from. While this information is very useful, one of the things that I've noticed in meeting with people is some of the communities that are newer to the state of Minnesota that are not necessarily represented in these statistics. For example, the West African community is growing in the state of Minnesota and Minneapolis. And what does that mean from a language standpoint? Many of the individuals from West African communities speak French. And that's something that I've been noticing in some of the work that I've done, that people have been asking for translations of documents in French and have been wanting individuals to come out and speak to them in French. So this historical analysis is very helpful just to kind of compare a century ago to today, where we saw the largest immigrant populations coming from, Austria-Hungary, Russia, and Italy in the early 1900s, to what the situation has been, at least as far as the latest, 2010 Yearbook of Immigration Statistics put out by the Department of Homeland Security, showing the significant percentage of immigrants nationwide who are obtaining permanent resident status from Mexico, and then increasing population of other countries, including Vietnam, El Salvador, and Colombia.
I just real quick wanted to jump in and point out that China doesn't show up until 1981, and that's because of the Chinese Exclusion Act did not get, it started in 1882 and did not actually get repealed until late 1940s. So it took some time before folks actually from China were able to come to the country. So I just wanted to name that.
Thank you for that.
It's a hidden part of our history, the Chinese Exclusion Act. So just
That's
wanted to
true.
Name that in the space.
Thank you. So key findings from the 8 months that this office has been operational. Creating a pathway to deliver competent immigration legal representation is something that's very important to increase stability in immigrant and refugee communities. While the majority of my work is focused on immigration legal services, I am aware of the many other needs and desires that immigrant and refugee communities have in our society, including access to health care, safe housing, non-discriminatory employment environment, educational opportunities. But I have to say that ensuring that people are not afraid of being deported from the United States seems to be the number one issue that, once it's addressed, enables people to focus on the rest of their lives. I also have found that there's a deficit of community knowledge of the existence of immigration-related legal services. While the nonprofit organizations that provide legal services in the Twin Cities area do a great job of pushing out the word about the existence of their organizations, there's still many individuals who have no idea that they can obtain the services of an immigration attorney free of charge, have no idea that there is a model of legal services, a clinic setting, where you can just walk in and have an appointment with an immigration attorney and not have to schedule it in advance or pay for it. So part of my work is to ensure that people are more aware of that model of delivery of legal services. And we're fortunate in that we have a relationship with Volunteer Lawyers Network, which that is their model of providing services through the legal clinic setting. I've also noted that community organizations are important partners in connecting residents to resources. As I've indicated, community organizations are very much trusted. Sometimes it's difficult to host a clinic and have people come out to a location that they're unfamiliar with because they're afraid that that will result in an immigration raid. Whereas certain community organizations that are well trusted have no difficulty in inviting people and then actually having 50, 100 people come for an information session. So it behooves me to ensure that we have a stronger relationship as possible with community organizations that provide this critical role. Also, city residents strongly support efforts to provide resources and assistance, and as I said before, represent an untapped source of support for residents facing immigration crises. Again, with this example of the I-9 audit, it was parents who were not at risk of removal from the United States at all who were contacting city council members or contacting the mayor's office and saying, the city needs to do something about this. What are we going to do? So it's exciting to hear. It also presents an opportunity for us to do more, or as much as we can. And then, as I indicated, city residents expect the city to take regular and visible actions to support immigrant and refugee communities. So with regard to next steps, identifying and pursuing partnerships that we can make with the entities that I've identified already, developing a plan to support residents interested in applying for U.S. citizenship, and part of that plan includes mapping out all the organizations that already provide the legal service of assisting people in applying for citizenship. Identifying resources for cash assistance for people who are subjected to or whose family members are subjected to immigration enforcement efforts. Often this results in an automatic and an instant change in a person's level of stability. It is challenging to find resources that people can access regardless of immigration status. So that's part of what I'm trying to do, is map out what resources exist. Provide leadership in immigrant and refugee-oriented events, and a couple of events that are going to be coming up that we will be participating in include World Refugee Day, which is June 20th, and Welcoming Week again this year, which will be in September. and then coordinating with partners and stakeholders in municipal planning impacting immigrant and refugee communities. There are a number of different groups that are engaged in the struggle to obtain measures of security in Minnesota. For example, the Multiracial Coalition, which is pushing for a driver's license on a state level, working with groups like that in an organic way to identify what individuals and groups can form a panel that would assist in the creation of policy on the part of the city of Minneapolis with regard to immigrant and refugee communities.
Great. I have a question from Council Vice President Jenkins.
Thank you, Chair Cunningham and Ms. Romero. I'm wondering if you can go back a few slides to the slide that indicates the number of immigrants coming to the country over time and the shift, the historical analysis. And I'm just curious, because you led with talking about the sort of ban or the ending of Liberian immigrants being able to stay in the country, but it doesn't, none of these maps or really indicate, none of these graphs indicate any significant African immigration. And I'm just wondering, was there a ban similar to the China ban? And I do believe there was at some point in time in our history of Africans coming to this country, but why aren't we seeing more African nations immigration patterns on these charts?
So Council President, Committee Chair Cunningham, Council Member Jenkins, the documentation that I have been able to collect regarding different immigrant communities, it is, I can say, challenging at best to obtain comprehensive information regarding specific immigrant communities. I think part of the problem is the statistics, and So the statistics and the breakdown of percentages, of Black or African American, in terms of the population of Minneapolis at least, the individuals aren't broken down by specific race. That is something that I'm trying to obtain more information about, but it is a challenge to try and obtain specific information. Often what I find myself doing is communicating with groups themselves, for example, Liberians in Minnesota, the Liberian Organization, Organization of Liberians in Minnesota, to identify what the specific population is for each nationality group.
I can imagine it is a challenge. I'm curious, are we partnering with other communities to address this Liberian, the ending of the refugee status for Liberians, and what's our federal partners' role in that?
So, Committee Chair Cunningham, Councilmember Jenkins, we have been working with nonprofit organizations, community organizations such as Black Immigrant Collective, in order to host legal clinics to ensure that people who may be losing their immigration status have access to attorneys to identify what other options may exist. That's one step. Another effort relates to working with the senators' offices and representatives' offices. Senator Tina Smith recently held a press conference addressing this specific issue and encouraging the Trump administration to extend deferred and forced departure for Liberians. One other measure is a bill that was introduced by Representative Phillips, which would enable individuals who are Liberians to obtain permanent resident status in the United States. One of the important discussion topics is not merely extending DED status, not merely extending deferred enforced departure, but providing a permanent option for individuals who have resided in the United States and are from Liberia, but who have been here for 20 years.
Yeah.
That's right, 20 years or more, for whom the United States is now their home, not Liberia. So I can attest to the fact that there is significant impetus in this area and desire, at least on the part of our elected officials, and that I'm in communication with those officials, and also that I'm communicating this information to impacted Liberians here in Minnesota. It remains to be seen what action the federal government will take and what action the federal legislature will take.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a few questions. Thank you so much for this update. I really appreciate it. It's been very helpful to see all this information in the breakdown. When I was looking at this, that's what I was actually wondering about, the Black and African American division, because we tend to get grouped together because of census data. And
yes.
So like when, I think it was 2015, there was a big drop in African American, like the Black family's median income. And a lot of folks didn't really realize that it was like, oh, well, we're actually talking about Somali families too.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about Black families and like how that impacts. And so I'm glad that we're, thank you to Council Vice President Jenkins for bringing that up. So I have a couple questions. The first is, what kind of engagement has been done on the north side with the immigrant and refugee community over there, and a little bit more specifically with Hmong residents and Laotian residents, because from my understanding, they were impacted by the revocation of TPS status. And so I'm just curious as to what kind of engagement there has been, or if there's collaboration with local organizations like the Lao Assistance Center and the Hmong American Partnership.
Yes, Committee Chair Cunningham, thank you so much for your question. The issue of the problems facing the Southeast Asian community have been on my radar since I started working for the city. I have had several meetings with Lao Assistance, with Sunny at Lao Assistance, in order to, one, introduce myself, and then also to identify concerns within that community. There is another organization called Released Minnesota 8, which is also very involved in the issue of repatriation of individuals from Southeast Asian countries and identifying ways to prevent repatriation, both on a state legislative level, and there's currently a bill at the state legislature which would enable people who have old criminal convictions to potentially reopen their criminal cases if their cases did not satisfy the requirements of due process, which include not knowing about the immigration consequences of a plea. So just being aware of that and then also communicating that information to potentially impacted individuals as part of the role of my office. Lao Assistance is also one of the places where I'm holding community hours. We're actually holding an event on April 4th. Lao Assistance has a relationship with a number of nonprofit organizations, some located in Minneapolis, some not. For example, CAPI is one example. Vietnamese Social Services, I believe, is another. And so we are trying to coordinate to see if we can provide a training to staff and then also have community hours so that people are aware of legal services that they can access to assist them. Because really, with regard to potentially impacted population and these concerns that we're seeing on the horizon, including the potential for repatriation, it's best to consult with an attorney before you're apprehended by immigration. And so that's part of the message that I'm trying to communicate.
Great. Thank you so much for that. And then I have one last question. It's not quite local, but it's just really relevant. Is there anything that we can do locally, either on an individual level or here as a city, in terms of helping children and families impacted by the family separation ordinance or policy down at the southern border?
So there are, the American Immigration Lawyers Association Minnesota Dakotas chapter is exceptionally active and sends attorneys to the border all the time. AILA, invites people who are interested in supporting those initiatives to communicate with the organization and provide financial support. It's also important to recognize that many of the individuals who are impacted by family separation make their way to different cities and states, including Minnesota. One nonprofit organization that provides a lot of assistance to impacted individuals is the Advocates for Human Rights, which often represents unaccompanied minors who are in immigration court proceedings. In fact, it's one of their objectives is to ensure that that community is represented in immigration court proceedings. So that's another excellent organization. Thank you. The Advocates for Human Rights, which is located in Minneapolis.
Great. That's what I thought. Just wanted to make sure. Thank you so much. I have a question from Council Member Cano.
Did you want me to go first?
Sure.
His thing was actually up first.
I just want to thank you and your department for everything you've done. You know, I think we have, the city still has work to do to fulfill its promise of being a sanctuary city, but we wouldn't be as far as we are without your work and being the point person for the city.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, colleagues, as you know, this is a very new endeavor for the city to have the Office of Immigrant Refugee Affairs, and it's probably one of the first in the Midwest and probably a handful in the nation. So the opportunity to lead conversations around this is fertile, and I think we have a big responsibility to do that. So I want to push us to go above and beyond the legal components of what we've seen here. I think that, you know, your background as a lawyer is really important, and we certainly have a lot of well-resourced organizations that provide legal services to immigrant communities when they are in a time of need. So while I appreciate being able to respond to communities in that way, and certainly I've been sending you the calls that I get when people text me saying, you know, I'm in this problem, who can I contact? Typically, I would send them to a law firm or Immigrant Law Center or Advocates for Human Rights, and now I send them to you. And so I'm assuming that somewhere along the way they get connected to a nonprofit that does this kind of work. So thinking about the reactive part of the work is important, and equally as important is sort of the proactive piece of it. And when I talk about proactive, I'm really talking about how do we change the narrative of how the issue of immigration is being played out in the country and how it impacts our city. So one proactive measure that many community members have discussed is the ability to have undocumented immigrants vote at the local municipal level, either on city council races, to vote for the mayor, to vote for school board members. And so I'm just curious what the conversation around that has been as a measure to push forward and advance, affirmatively advance what we want our communities to be and to have versus always fighting off the attacks that our communities are getting vis-a-vis legal recourse when we are obviously faced with a broken immigration system that inevitably ends up deporting a lot of people no matter how much legal support we throw their way. So what have you heard about that in terms of, you know, are other states doing this? Are other cities doing this? How is the conversation in Minneapolis looking or feeling like on this topic?
Thank you. Committee Chair Cunningham, Council Member Cano, thank you very much for your question. I have heard of other municipalities, there's one in California, I believe, that does allow undocumented individuals to vote in local elections, including school board. There is another initiative which is along the lines of what you're talking about. It's a state initiative to allow individuals to work in the United States, and something that is created by state law as opposed to by federal law. Those are initiatives that represent ways to challenge the status quo and ways to challenge the conventional wisdom regarding what individuals who are undocumented or who do not have U.S. citizenship are permitted to do in the United States. With regard to more forward-thinking conversations and participating in those conversations, I am involved in working with nonprofit organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union and academia as well, which are pushing the envelope on these types of justifications for granting additional rights to individuals regardless.
Dear listeners, audience, if you want to join us and continue to listen to this presentation, so important, please dial now 515-605-9891 if you're listening by way of the computer or your am360.org. It will go to another already pre-recorded podcast. All right? That's 515-605-9891 or 425-292-4253. Okay? Thank you very much. And join us tonight
to multiple racial communities throughout the city that are impacted by this issue of immigration and refugee status. Can you give us a preview of what your office is thinking about or what the budget request might look like for next year in terms of the vision for the work, the type of resources that might be needed, and anything else related to that?
Committee Chair Cunningham, Councilmember Cano, those are discussions that I'm involved in within our department. There is certainly a significant, as I've indicated, need for financial assistance in the legal services context. It's interesting to compare the city of Minneapolis with the city of St. Paul, for example. Also, with regard to support of community organizations, I think that that's something that has to factor into the discussion. Once I have more concrete information, I'm happy to share with the council members and with other individuals involved in the decision-making process.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Cano. Next up, we have Councilmember Gordon.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the work that you've done. I also appreciate the work that you helped when we were talking about what to do about the county jail and helping to get some information there. I'm wondering if you know of any other progress that we've made in terms of renegotiating our contract there. I think that's where the city council ended up, was asking us to go back and renegotiate the contract. And I know that didn't fall on your shoulders, and that was in the coordinator's office. But have you been part of any of those discussions?
Committee Chair Cunningham, Councilmember Gordon, I have not. My understanding is with regard to Hennepin County Jail that they are examining their jail policies. So to the extent that that is useful in this conversation, I think that it is a positive development.
I will note that I think there have been some positive developments and changes since we did that,
mm-hmm.
But it would still be nice to get things, in my opinion, in the contract, and hopefully we're following up on that, so I appreciate that. I also was trying to look up our legislative agenda because I can't remember if the issue of immigrant voting rights is in it. But I've done some research on that, and we've got a big problem in Minnesota because back in the, I think it was maybe the 40s, they amended the state constitution to prohibit immigrant voting rights. Even though when we were a territory and we became a state, you can bet who was voting on that were all recent immigrants. So that is an issue that's going to be challenging for us and something I'd love to dig into. But and I'll probably see if we even got it on our legislative agenda, which I think we may have, but I'm not sure, to at least support the possibility of immigrants voting in local elections. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Okay, thank you.
I have one last question. Is it on the city's legislative agenda with driver's license?
I believe so.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just wanted to double check to make sure. Great. Do any of my other colleagues have any questions? Thank you, everyone, for that robust conversation. Thank you for your work.
You've
been growing it up from like the very beginning. And so thank you so much for your leadership.
Thank you all.
Of course. So with that, I would like to move to receive and file information relating to the mission and activities of the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. The ayes have it, and that item carries. Our last agenda item for today is a presentation on the Community Connections Conference. We have Nick. All right. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair Cunningham. Good afternoon, council members. My apologies. I have a little bit of a cold today, so if I'm popping up, don't worry. Today I'm here to request for an action to receive and file a summary report and evaluation of this year's Community Connections Conference. Before I begin, I would like to say that this event in itself is a very unique city event. I'm not very sure of any other cities that typically does a conference, so it involves a heavy and significant investment not only from our city, but our partners, our neighborhood organizations, city departments, community organizations, and with the resounding mission of building capacity as well as collaboration, either forging new collaborations or strengthening ongoing partnerships that are out there. So the conference started in 2012, and since then it has grown significantly, and every year we do our best to offer a unique, I guess, experience in the programming and space for all our attendees. And the outcome really is not the event, which is a great outcome, but really how we get there in terms of how we work with our partners. So the conference is a citywide event, and when it first started, it really focused around Minneapolis, but within the past few years, it has grown to 20 cities. And then we've had involvement not only from our partners at Metro Transit, but as well as different agencies through the state of Minnesota. And really, the conference is a one-day event that's meant to be a safe, inclusive, and accessible environment for honest dialogue, experiential learning, as well as, I mentioned, collaboration building. So the program in itself consists of diverse speakers and workshops, as well as presentations that takes place throughout the day, focus on current day topics, historical issues. There are special presentations on collaboration building, as well as community building, and then what are best practices for engagement. Equally with our programming, we have an exhibit space, and really that's where our partnering organizations and departments showcases their work, as well as new initiatives. It's an opportunity to not only network with each other, but network with different residents that are within the Twin Cities area. And then this is a kind of an invisible third program part, but it's our lunchtime. Really, we at the Neighborhood and Community Relations Department emphasize the importance of breaking bread, so sitting down at a table, sharing a meal, and through that we have authentic conversations. So within the past 5 years, the lunch hour has grown to not only be, you know, a time to eat, but a time to reconnect with old friends and partners, as well as build new connections as well. So this year's conference, we had about 885 attendees compared to the 694 last year. So that's a 22% increase. And what that really shows is that, again, the conference has grown to be a Twin Cities event, as well as something for a lot of organizations and residents to look forward to and to share their work and to share a lot of their success. During the registration process, we have a voluntary demographic survey. So this year, of the 885 people that registered, 708 took that survey on a racial demographics, and it indicates that this year we had 42% people of color. The 2017 American Community Survey indicates that Minneapolis had a 32% people of color demographic, so we actually exceeded the city's racial parity. And then for our neighborhood representation, we had 84 neighborhoods represented, so neighborhoods, not neighborhood organizations. And then for this particular portion of the survey, we had 790 responses. So every year, as we sit down to try to plan out the next event, we want to try to create a more intentional programming to make sure that whether you are a new attendee or a returning attendee, you're able to enter the conversation at a comfortable speed. And we do that by making sure that we work with our city departments as well as our community leaders and members to figure out what conversations they would like to have, what would they like to talk about, and what would they want to do at the conference to move forward past that event. And that was something that was emphasized by a lot of our returning partners as well as attendees, is that although the conference is a one-day event, what can we do past that day? So this year's theme was Together, Mobilizing for a Better Minneapolis, recognizing that there are a lot of big bodies of work that the city is currently going through, as well as nationally as too, as my colleague has mentioned with immigration and refugee-related work. And then we had a total of 21 workshops. A good portion of them were city-led workshops since it's 2020. Neighborhoods 2020, immigration. And then we had a lot of workshops that were provided by our neighborhood organizations as well as our community-led organizations, which focus on engaging renters, crime reduction strategies, mental health. And then we also had a new initiative that we started last year, and that was incorporating in an opening panel as well as a closing forum, recognizing that we wanted to start the day with each other to kind of be on the same breath as well as close out with each other as well. So this year's panel was Connecting Community Activism to Change, and it featured local artists and community organizers that are sharing their personal stories and experiences in terms of grassroots organizing, mobilizing their particular communities, and then affecting systemic change. And then for our closing forum, we had the first of many conversations on the city's strategic racial equity action plan. And that was led by our race and equity division up in the city coordinator's office. Both particular pieces, I believe the opening panel had about 350 people in attendance. And for the closing forum, it was roughly around 150 people. And as mentioned, the exhibit hall or the exhibit space is one of our primary engines for the conference. It's an opportunity to showcase a lot of your work. So this year we had up to 137 different exhibitors that were from our city departments, local government agencies, as well as community organizations as well. So this is where a lot of the energy is at during the conference in terms of people connecting, networking. There are different activities for families, as well as activities to teach about different topics and issues that are going on. Something that we also incorporated in this year as well is a legal clinic as well. We had a free legal clinic for folks to come and get consults on immigration and housing-related issues. We had also a free HIV testing on-site as well. And as our conference has grown, we have grown out of the space that we typically were at. So this year we're in a larger exhibit hall as well. And I want to say thank you to a lot of our city departments for providing a fire truck. Public Works provided a electrical fleet car. And then Metro Transit also provided one of their newer bus lines as well. So definitely a lot of different things that we wanted to incorporate within our exhibit space. Lastly, again, a special thank you to our partners. Metro Transit not only provided a bus, but they were on site as well as provided free transportation to our attendees. So folks were able to go online and download a pass, and they were able to ride and leave the conference free of charge. CenterPoint has been our fiscal sponsor, I believe, since the beginning of the conference. And then we partner with a lot of different community organizations to do grassroots campaign to educate people about what the conference does, as well as what advantages they could get out of the conference. And then, of course, we have our food partners as well to provide a great lunch service to everyone. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you so much. All right, not seeing any questions. From your perspective, what do you think, or maybe there's data, what was the most attended workshop of the day?
Jared Cunningham, I believe the most attended workshop of the day by sheer numbers was our Neighborhoods 2020 workshop. Yep.
Shocking. no one ever. All right. No, these numbers are wonderful. So thank you, team, for all your hard work to get these many folks out for an all-day event, being able to really be in community and with one another in a very unique way that we don't see other cities really taking leadership with. So thank you so much for your leadership on this. And I'm excited that there were lots of good conversations. I heard about the in-depth topics that were covered, and I was really excited to hear that. With that, all right, thank you so much. I would like to move to receive and file the Community Connections Conference Report for 2019. All of those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it, and that item passes. Seeing no further business on the agenda, we are adjourned.
You're listening to America Muslim 360, believer-supported radio. Assalamu alaikum. This is Rajia Mukmin with Al Mukminu Islamic Center, asking you to become a contributing supporter of CWSC and AM 360 at the most popular giving level of just $9.99 per month. Visit CWSC.us today to make your tax-deductible gift, or call in your pledge at 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world. Thank you.
CWSC invites you to join the National Dawah Campaign, Hot Off the Press. We're pleased to offer the 2020 CWSC Limited Edition Remaking Our World Islamic History Calendar. This beautiful publication is a 12-month wall calendar commemorating the leadership of Imam Muhammad and the history of an American Muslim community. This keepsake features Al-Quran and Hadith, the commentary of Imam Muhammad, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish holy days, the critically acclaimed contextual biography on the life of America's Imam, Islamic universal beliefs, analysis one of the most intriguing chapters in America, Muslim, and world history. And it makes the 10th anniversary of American Muslim 360 Radio Network. That's right, we're celebrating 10 years. Purchase your limited edition copy at CWSC.us. That's CWSC.us. Or order by phone at 910.
If you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you loved your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people a better day is coming for you and for me. With just a little bit more education and love for our nation would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say. And how long have you held your white teacher? Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people a better day is coming for you and for me. With just a little bit more education and love for our nation would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers?
If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? If you had a chance.
See the full picture.
Fill the void.
Read the Muslim Journal.
Bringing humanity together.
It's news with truth.
It's journalism with understanding.
Each week, Muslim Journal features the latest headline stories. Get a fresh perspective on American politics with informative editorials on the news and stories that affect you and your community the most. Muslim Journal also features exciting reports from around the globe. Subscribe to the Muslim Journal and stay informed about the world we live in today.
See the full picture.
Subscribe to the Muslim Journal today.
Hey, dear listening audience, thank you for being right here to the most listened to Islamic radio station in the nation, American Muslim 360 broadcast. Please plan to join us again tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when Imam Kareem Hamid shares with us the journey of the journal, speaking of the Muslim Journal. And following that at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Mark Shaheed and El Princess Aziz and Munira Habil, they all bring to us Parenting and Family Reconstruction. That's the CWSC Learning Lab. And following that at 9 p.m., Not Just Talk by Mahassan Abdul Salam and Michael Hameen. Thank you once again for being an avid listener right here on the most listened to Islamic radio station in the nation. I am one of the program managers, Martha Naila Abdullah and Quran Shakir. We thank you, and on behalf of the acting CEO, Latifa Hameen, and the Director of Model Community National Resource Directory, Dipreetha Hadi, and the CWSC Executive Director, Mukhtar Muhammad, and the CEO of AM360, CEO Emeritus, Dr. Aisha Kareem, and all of our department leaders. And while our AM360 CEO is on a leave, that's Imam Abdul Hakim Abdullah. We all extend to you greetings. And again, on behalf of all the leaders, our department leaders, our advisors, and our hosts right here on American Muslim 360 broadcast, and all of our listeners, you are important to us. We are thankful. We thank Almighty God for each and every one of our contributions. Continue to listen. As peace be upon you.